Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We have been dealing with one of Shakespeare's most famous and important plays, his last full-length play, The Tempest, a work that has been an enormous influence down through literary history, in addition to being greatly popular because it has a plot that almost seems as if it were out of a fairy tale. On a desert island, a group of people are shipwrecked by the tempest of the title. Only we learn quickly in the opening scenes of Act One that this has been a deliberate tempest conjured by the magic of Prospero, the magician who has been marooned here with his daughter Miranda for 12 years. And lo and behold, who are the members of this ship but the very people that exiled Prospero 12 years ago, now fallen into his hand, though they do not yet know that and will in fact not know it until the very last act. Nonetheless, he caused the tempest, and now he has strewn the various members of the ship around the island in various symbolic groupings, where he is about to begin putting them through various ordeals. We will talk about why he does that as we go along, but that is the plot. Separate them into appropriate groups and put each group through the ordeal appropriate to that group of people. And we had arrived at the opening of Act 2, Scene 1, which concerns the so-called court party. The court being spoken of is the court of Naples. The ruling figure in the court party is Alonso, who is, or at least was, the king of Naples before the shipwreck. In addition, there are three courtiers, servants and advisors of the ruling figure, two evil courtiers, Antonio and Sebastian, and the wise, good courtier, Gonzalo, who have already distinguished themselves as a contrast as early as the Tempest scene itself, the very first scene of the drama. There are a couple of other members who don't really do or say much in the course of the play, but this is the main grouping of the court party. And Alonso is sunk in deep grief and depression, thinking that his son has been drowned in the shipwreck, which we know is not true, but he thinks so, and that triggers his guilt because he helped to depose Prospero 12 years ago. And he now bitterly regrets that, and he thinks that this is the vengeance of fate or the gods or somebody causing his son to die by drowning and himself to be punished by this exile. And he is sunk into a kind of clinical depression. Gonzalo is trying very hard to cheer him up by getting him to see basically the glass as half full rather than half empty. Look, sire, look on the good side. And here we are on an island where we could live. We could make something out of this island. And he goes through a famous speech about what could happen if he were governor of the island. If I were king on it, what would I do? And he goes through a long description of an island that we rather quickly realize is essentially paradiso. There is no need of work because the island gives forth freely all of its fertility. There is no need of rule because people are good and all get along. And essentially, he says at the end of it, I would with such perfection govern, sir, to excel the golden age. Well, he would not only excel it, he would essentially recreate it, because the description, which is very exact in its details, those details are exactly those of the descriptions of the classical Golden Age, the first of the so-called four or five ages of man. The most famous version is that in the opening of Ovid's Metamorphoses. Ovid is in turn working from the earlier account of Hesiod in the Theogony. But the first age was the best and greatest. It was the Golden Age. And the details are exactly drawn from that. I would bring back the Golden Age. Antonio and Sebastian, being the cynics that they are, simply laugh at this, simply deride it, simply sneer at it. And it does seem, at first, to be characterizing Gonzalo as this impossible naive, almost a Don Quixote, almost crazy naive, not to recognize the reality around him. We are marooned on a desert island. Get over it. And it is true that what Gonzalo is talking about is an ideal that goes beyond the possibilities of the human condition. Now, we are not in the Golden Age anymore, because that was an unfallen age. There is an exact counterpart to the unfallen age of the Garden of Eden in the Bible. And that was possible because human nature also was unfallen. And Antonio and Sebastian are living proof that human nature is very much not unfallen now. That's the problem. And therefore, what good is talking about, if I ruled the island, I would recreate the Golden Age? That is foolishly, naively impossible, and we grudgingly grant that, though they are jerks, Antonio and Sebastian seem to have more of a reality sense than Gonzalo. We have to be careful, though, as always in Shakespeare, to note things that could easily go by. The God is in the details, Einstein said, and the meaning of the play is in the details in Shakespeare. Gonzalo, in the midst of the sneering, speaks to Alonso, who says, "You're not cheering me up. Thou dost talk nothing to me. Nothing you say is going to do any good," he says. He keeps being stubborn about it. Gonzalo replies, and it's important to note, "I do well believe, Your Highness, and did it to minister occasion to these gentlemen, who are such sensible and nimble lungs that they always used to laugh at nothing." What he's saying is, I did not speak this naively. I am not naive. I did not mean my speech literally. I know it's literally impossible. Why did I go through with it? Because I simply decided I would give these two a laugh. They laugh at absolutely anything. They sneer at everything. So, okay, I'll give them a cheap laugh. So he pretended to be naively believing that this was possible, just to give them the chance to be the cynical jerks that they are. But we have to be even additionally careful. That does not necessarily mean that Gonzalo thinks that his vision was idle and worthless. It is not true on a literal level, but beyond the literal format of it, does it still mean something? Does it still symbolize something? And that we will have to wait and see all the way to the end of the play. Here, that vision of the Golden Age is simply set up in the midst of the ocean. And almost on cue, and as a matter of fact, very definitely on cue, because this has all been stage managed, and in fact continues to be stage managed by Prospero. You could say that the bulk of the action in The Tempest consists of a play within a play, in the sense that the events that are taking place are all being stage managed and puppeteered by Prospero invisibly. He is puppeteering these people using Ariel, who is constantly faced with the task of living up to the repeated stage direction, enter invisible, meaning invisible to the other characters of the play, visible to the audience, of course. Ariel here comes in playing solemn music, and the music is hypnotic. It puts the rest of the court party, except for Antonio and Sebastian, quickly asleep. They simply drop over so suddenly that Sebastian and Antonio are startled by it. "What a strange drowsiness possesses them," Sebastian says. Antonio says it must be the quality of the climate. And he goes on to say they fell together all as by consent. They just fell over like on cue. What is going on here? But useful to us, because now we can plot with nobody eavesdropping us. It's a small island, and now we've got some privacy. "And by the way," Antonio says to Sebastian, "I see a crown dropping upon thy head." At this point, Antonio, who is the brother, as we recall, of Prospero, and who deposed his own brother, saying to Sebastian, who is the brother of Alonso, so we have two brother relationships here, both of them bad. Antonio is basically saying, "Hey, it worked for me, and why don't we try that again with your brother, Alonso? We deposed Prospero, that worked out well for us. And now, let us think of trying that with Alonso." And they begin to plot the murder of Alonso and presumably the rest of the court party, in order that they may usurp what in the world, we wonder as we go through this play, what in the world possesses these people, because we will also see the comic lowlife characters trying to do the same thing, foment some sort of insurrection or revolution in order to take over without ever questioning their situation. You're all on a desert island, stranded with, so far as you know, no way off of it. What do you want to commit murder to rule over this piece of desert by your own description? What sense does that make? And it does not make normal sense. But these are not normal people. These are people possessed by evil and the will to power. And this is simply what such people do. Give them an opportunity to see some sort of power, and they are almost compelled, they are possessed by the will to power enough to take it. We will grant, with these two more sophisticated characters, that what their ultimate object is not just rule over this desert island. Ultimately, they are plotting to go back to Naples and rule there. If we eliminate Alonso, the king of Naples, well then, who's the next heir, Antonio asks of Naples? Claribel. Claribel is the sister of Ferdinand, the daughter of Alonso. In other words, she would be next in line for the inheritance. They think that Ferdinand is dead. They just got done saying around lines 237 of Act Two, Scene One, that it's impossible that he's undrowned, he meaning Ferdinand. And therefore, with Ferdinand gone, if we eliminated Alonso, the inheritance would go to Clarabel. But no problem, she is queen of Tunis. She dwells 10 leagues beyond man's life. She is way in the middle of nowhere, and she would not be able to come back and rule over Naples. So it would fall to you, Sebastian. So their ultimate object is to rule Naples. That still does not make this a realistic plan, mind you, because they have no idea how they're going to get back there, but we'll solve that problem. Let's start murdering now so that we'll have it all set up and have ourselves positioned for when we get back someday. Here lies your brother, let's murder him, and without further ado, they draw. Enter Ariel again with music and song and wakes everybody up. They spring up suddenly and are totally confused. And Alonso asks, why are you drawn? Why do you have your swords drawn? And they have to quickly fake it. Oh, well, we heard a terrible noise, a bellowing like bulls or rather lions. Didn't it wake you up? It struck mine ear most terribly. So that plan is foiled. And yet, it brings us to a discussion of what the party had been doing. How did they get here when they were shipwrecked? And we have to pause and look at the symbolic overtones of the trip that was interrupted by the tempest and the shipwreck that came out of the tempest. They were sailing back from the wedding in North Africa, in Tunis, in North Africa. Clarabel had just been married to, Alonso's daughter had just been married to the king of Tunis in North Africa, and they were sailing back across the Mediterranean and back to Italy, and are suddenly interrupted by this sojourn on this island. This brings back a reference that another time that Antonio and Sebastian have been making fun of Gonzalo when he refers to Tunis as Carthage. Tunis, the location of Tunis is close to Carthage. But nevertheless, it's not literally Carthage. So we have Gonzalo again seeming to be naively literal. He even says, this Tunis, sir, was Carthage, which is equivalent to saying, if you meant it literally, this Detroit, sir, was Cleveland. It's not literally true, but it sets up, as we have noted before, a parallel with Virgil's Aeneid, in which we have a sea voyage that is interrupted midway through, searching for the new Troy. Aeneas and his people are the survivors of the fall of Troy, and they know that they are going to be given, according to the legend that Virgil's Aeneid operates according to, they have been promised by the gods a new Troy that will not be called Troy, but something else. And eventually they learn that what it will be called is Rome. The Romans are descended from the Trojans, led by Aeneas. This is all told in Virgil's Aeneid, a work of literature that had an enormous pervasive influence on Shakespeare. It did on everyone else, too, all the way beyond Shakespeare's time, all the way up to the 20th century. But definitely in play after play of Shakespeare. And on their way to sailing from North Africa, from Troy, Aeneas and his people land in North Africa, in Carthage. And Aeneas has a flaming famous love affair with Dido, Queen of Carthage, but eventually he has to abandon her and leave and go to Italy to found Rome. But before he does that, he has a sojourn in which he goes down to the underworld. And he is required to do that, just as Odysseus is required to make a trip to the underworld in order to get where he's actually going. That means that this shipwreck on this desert island suddenly takes on, through the imagery, the overtones of a descent to the underworld quest and the knowledge and rebirth that come out of that for Aeneas. That theme has been suddenly imported into The Tempest. And all of these parallels had been noted clear back in 1921 by a pioneering critic named Colin Still in a pioneering work called Shakespeare's Mystery Play. It is in some ways a rather maverick work of scholarship, and yet it made a great impression on a number of important people. One of them is T.S. Eliot, and Colin Still's work is probably a main reason, in addition to Shakespeare himself, that there are numerous allusions and even quotations from Shakespeare's Tempest in Eliot's poem, The Wasteland. And it was also a great influence on Northrop Frye, by his own admission. And Still pointed out that the descent to the underworld in Virgil's Aeneid had been drawn, we don't know what sources, but we know that Virgil was drawing on some sort of religious sources, some sort of mystery in the religious sense. Shakespeare's Mystery Play is the title of Still's work. And the mysteries were late classical religions in which the initiates went through a death and rebirth initiation with all sorts of symbolism, which could include going underground, as if into the tomb and back, but also underwater, down into water, and being reborn like Atlantis out of it again. So simply by these allusions sprinkled through The Tempest, suddenly, a whole larger dimension of the imagery is put into place, and we will see the point of that as we go along. So what looks like idle banter trying to cheer ourselves up on a desert island turns out to be crucial in putting the imagery in place that will make this all mean something more than just a sort of elevated fairy tale. We move on then to Act 2, Scene 2, and Shakespeare is still not done introducing the characters. It's a very short play, and he has a lot of characters, so he has to do his usual thing of introducing a group of them at a time, usually scene by scene, and that typically does go into the opening part of the second act in order to get them all in place. And we have one more set to be introduced to, via Caliban, who in scene two enters stage direction with a burden of wood. He is hauling wood, which is his normal job, manual labor. We will find that this job is going to be given over to Ferdinand, the prince, in order to win Miranda, the hand of Miranda from Prospero. But it's Caliban's day job, and here he is hauling the wood, but here's a noise of thunder as if the tempest was going to return. And he needs to take some shelter, and does so by simply covering himself up, and especially because he sees, in addition to the storm, he sees enter one of the two low life, lower class, and therefore low behaving characters, Stefano and Trinculo. Trinculo enters. This is someone who's never seen before, another survivor from the ship, but he doesn't know that. He thinks it's a spirit of Prospero's. Prospero purportedly has quite a number of magical servants, and they torment Caliban, and we can infer from his speeches, despite his disgruntlement, he thinks it's all very unfair, but the reason he gets tormented is because he doesn't act right, he misbehaves, and therefore Prospero seeks the other magical. These are elemental creatures that serve Prospero through his magic. And he thinks that Trinculo is another one of these. Oh, here comes a spirit of his, and to torment me for bringing wood in slowly. I'll fall flat, perhaps he will not mind me, and he lies down with his cloak completely covering him. Trinculo enters. Trinculo, if you consult the Dramatis Personae, is a jester. He is the jester figure from the court. He is not, as we quickly find, however, he is not one of the wise, oracular jesters or clowns or fools like Fest in Twelfth Night, like the fool in King Lear. He is quite simply just a fool, just a clown. He and Stefano are the lower order characters who, as usual in Shakespeare, not very politically correct, but the lower class characters are usually made fun of in the subplot. There are usually, in a Shakespearean comedy, and the romances follow the same pattern, there are one, if not two, contrapuntal main plots, and then a humorous, satiric subplot with the lower class characters. And here they come in this play. Trinculo, who is a jester, and he also sees the storm coming, and any port in a storm. He sees Caliban with a cloak, a nice rain-repellent cloak, thinks that it must be a dead native, though he's not quite sure. Seeing Caliban, he makes a speech. What have we here, a man or a fish, dead or alive? Ugh, a fish. He smells like a fish. A very ancient and fish-like smell, a kind of not of the newest, poor John. A strange fish. Were I in England now, as once I was, and had but this fish painted, not a holiday fool there, but would give a piece of silver. There would this monster make a man. Any strange beast there makes a man. While they will not give a doit to relieve a lame beggar, they will lay out 10 to see a dead Indian. Low humor, but we laugh at it. A man or a fish, Caliban is often said to be fish-like. We're never quite sure what that exactly means, and given the theme of perception in the play, that aspects of things look different to people according to their level of vision, we are not quite sure how literally Caliban is fish-like, but at any rate, he's associated with fishy imagery, and he is here by Trinculo with a little bit of crude joking about, oh man, I could make a fortune selling views of him if I were back in England. They'll give money for any damn fool thing like this. And of course, the English members of the audience are laughing at this. But at any rate, he seems to be dead, and he's got a cloak that will keep off the rain that looks to be coming. Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. I will here shroud to the dregs of the storm. be passed. So he creeps in to this cloak, thinking he's crawling in with the corpse of a dead native. Enter the second lowlife character, Stefano. Stage directions, singing with a bottle in his hand. Because in the dramatis personae, he is listed by description as a drunken butler, drunk on his butt. And as a matter of fact, the butt is literal because we learn quickly that he floated in to shore on a butt of sack of liquor, appropriately because he's an alcoholic. So we get all the alcoholic type of jokes that we got back in Twelfth Night with Sir Toby Belch. And he's drunkenly singing patches of songs. And he sings one that is one of the more famous songs, though it is certainly not the kind of haunting lyricism of Full Fathom Five. Quite the reverse. It's basically an obscene song. The master, the swabber, the bosun, and I, the gunner and his mate, loved Moll, Meg, and Marion, and Marjorie, but none of us cared for Kate. And Kate is portrayed in humorously sexist terms. She loved not the savor of tar nor of pitch, in other words, of sailors, yet a tailor might scratch her where'er she did itch. Then to sea boys and let her go hang. And he drinks. Caliban is afraid. Caliban calls out, "Do not torment me." And Stefano is amazed. And of course, Stefano is so drunk, it's hard to say, is this the alcohol or did something really happen? And what he sees before him is what looks to him like a creature with four legs, because Trinculo has crawled in, apparently, in the reverse direction from Caliban under the cloak, so that is a set of legs protruding from either end. And this is some monster of the isle with four legs, who hath got, as I take it, an ague. Where the devil should he learn our language? Well, I'll help him learn the language. Open your mouth. You do have a mouth, right? I'll give you that which will give you language. And he gives Caliban liquor and begins giving him liquor and continues to give him liquor until by the end of the scene, Caliban is as drunk as he is, if not drunker, because Caliban, according to the vicious cliches of colonialism, is the native who can't handle white man's firewater. A cliche apparently already in place in the early 16th century. Shakespeare being amazingly prophetic of the later history of colonialism and imperialism. Prospero is the picture of a colonial governor who is well-intentioned and noble-minded, though it doesn't go well with the native Caliban. The other side of imperialism is knowing exploitation and making fun of the natives, and that's Stefano and Trinculo. And Caliban is portrayed, insofar as we see him as a native people of a far-flung land, he is portrayed in stereotyped terms, an ignorant savage, easily gotten drunk on firewater, and so superstitious that he ends up worshiping. He thinks these two people are gods. That's a brave god and bears celestial liquor. I will kneel to him. And he goes on to say, this is a greater god. I will switch my worship from the god that I already had, my native god, whose name is Setebos. Robert Browning has a dramatic monologue by Caliban called Caliban upon Setebos about the primitive impulses of religion. And Caliban's religion is simply savage superstition. And he's easily persuaded that these two are gods, which is about the opposite of the truth. These are the lowest level of the social ladder in the play. They aren't as evil as Antonio and Sebastian. They're just idiots. Nonetheless, they too are hatching a plot to murder the ruling figure and rule the island. They quickly come up with the idea that they could rule if they got rid of Prospero. And that terrifically excites Caliban, who hates being ruled by Prospero. And therefore, the end of both the scene and of Act Two is Caliban yelling, "Freedom, Haide, freedom," over and over again. And he's going to lead them to Prospero. And they will try to foment a rebellion. And of course, we already know it's probably not going to go well for them, but they're too foolish to know that. And we will continue to follow their fortunes and the fortunes of the other members of the shipwreck next week.